also fond of his slightly younger son, Al-Mamun, the son of a concubine, and he thought that Al-Mamun had a greater talent for governing. In the end, he made a strange, almost Frankish arrangement. He decreed that while Al-Amin would succeed him as caliph, Al-Mamun would become governor of Khorasan and his brother's heir. As Al-Amin had children of his own, this was not to his liking. He insisted that Al-Mamun come to Baghdad and recognize Al-Amin's oldest son as the heir. But for 2 years, Al-Mamun refused to come. If he left Khorasan, the chances were that he would never return. At the same time, he stopped sending any reports to Baghdad and removed Al-Amin's name from its place in the official mottos, embroidered on the robes of state used at Khorasan, all acts that declared his independence. Al-Amin retaliated by ordering that no one was to pray for Al-Mamun anymore during the Friday sermons. When Al-Mamun received word of this, he realized that his brother was preparing to depose him as governor of Khorasan. He began to prepare for war, and Al-Amin did the same. In the early days of 811, the armies of the two brothers met in battle. The army of Al-Mamun, although smaller, outfought and defeated the caliph's forces. Al-Mamun's victory was in no small part due to the brilliant leadership of his chief general, a man named Tahir. Once hostilities were in the open, fighting went on, and for over a year, the Abbasid Empire was divided by civil war. Al-Mamun's rebel army captured Hamadan, Basra, and Kufa. Mecca and Medina both declared themselves against the Abbasid caliph and placed their loyalty with Al-Mamun instead. In a little over a year, Al-Mamun had arrived at Baghdad, not as a loyal subject and brother, but as an invading conqueror. Al-Amin and his men barricaded the city's gates, and for another year the siege dragged on. The walls, pounded by siege engines, began to crumble. Merchants sailing into the city were forced to duck a fusillade of rocks hurled by Al-Mamun's catapults. The surrounding villages were forced to surrender. Those that refused were burned to the ground. Inside Baghdad, the people grew desperate, hungry, and lawless. On the outside, Al-Mamun's general, Tahir, promised that anyone who left the city and came over to the attacker's side would be treated well and given gifts. At the end of the summer of 813, the defenders finally gave up. Tahir led his master's army into the city. In the fighting and chaos that followed, Al-Amin tried to swim across the Tigris to safety. A band of soldiers captured him, beheaded him, and brought the head to Tahir, who presented it to his master. Al-Mamun, who had conveniently not been in on the decision to execute his brother, prostrated himself in grief. But this did not prevent Al-Amin's head from being stuck up on the city walls, the fate of usurpers and rebels, not of duly appointed caliphs. Al-Mamun was proclaimed rightful caliph, and by September most of the empire had dutifully agreed to obey him. But the authority he had seized by force never sat easily in his hands. He was forced to put down a serious rebellion in 815, and another in 817, led by his own uncle. Troubles down in Egypt, where the people were unhappy with their tax burden and their governor, were continuous. He was losing his grip on the east. He had given the governorship of Khorasan over to his general Tahir, out of gratitude for the man's service, and Tahir had begun to pay less and less attention to commands from his caliph. One Friday evening, Tahir did not pray for the caliph during his Friday sermon, a clear declaration of his own independence. Al-Mamun's intelligence agents in Khorasan immediately sent word of this defiance to Baghdad, but on that same night, Tahir died. A certain amount of confusion surrounded his death. One of his younger sons claimed that he died of a sudden high fever that struck him while he slept. An official reported that he was actually talking to Tahir when the governor's face convulsed, and he fell down in the middle of a speech. However it happened, his death seemed like good news to Al-Mamun, who clapped his hands when news of Tahir's end reached him, right after the report of his old friend's defiance. "Praised be to God," he announced, "who has sent Tahir on to the next life and kept us back." His celebration was premature. Tahir's oldest son, Talha, picked up his father's defiance and declared himself ruler of Khorasan. A new dynasty had joined the already divided Muslim empire. The Tahirids, who would rule in the east, paying empty respect to the authority of the caliph, but acting in independence. Al-Mamun had won his position by conquest, and he held on to it for his entire life. He ruled as caliph until his death from typhoid in 833, and was succeeded by the heir he had designated, his half-brother, Al-Mutasim. But Talha also passed on his authority to his brother, and the Tahirids grew in power in the east, just as the Umayyads had in Al-Andalus. Now, three Islamic dynasties ruled in the once unified Muslim lands, and the fractures would continue to spread. Chapter 56. The Vikings. Between 813 and 862, the Empire of Charlemagne divides into four pieces. Viking longships sail down the Seine, and the Rus make their first appearance at Constantinople. By 813, Charlemagne's imperial power had been recognized, however grudgingly, by both Byzantium and Baghdad. He claimed to rule lands as far north as Scandinavia, where he had campaigned against the little tribal kingdoms of the Suetidi, known to us as the Swedes. The Dani, or the Danes, and the Hordaland and Rogaland peoples in the lands that are now Norway. He had extended his empire down into the Spanish Marches, the mountainous land between the Emirate of Cordoba and the Frankish border. March comes from the Frankish word for borderland. He controlled the northern part of Italy, the old Lombard kingdom, and acted as the protector of the Papal States in the middle of the peninsula. He was the master of the dukes who ruled the Italian territories of Spoleto and Benevento. He was nearing 70 years old and intended to leave his kingdom divided among his three sons in the traditional Frankish manner. The will he had drawn up in 806 split the kingdom into thirds, giving each son complete independence. His heirs were expected to cooperate only in the defense of the Church of St. Peter. He was the Emperor of the Romans, but this did not, in his mind, mean that he now ruled a Roman Empire that should be passed on hold to his successor. It meant that he had an obligation to defend the Pope and to establish God's kingdom on earth. His plans to divide his lands came to nothing. By 813, only one son was still alive. His third son, Pippin, subject king in Italy, died in 810. Charles the Younger, his heir apparent, suffered a fatal stroke the following year. His only remaining heir was his youngest son, Louis the Pious, who was 35 years old and currently ruling as a sub-king to his father in the Frankish territory of Aquitaine. Author's note, Pippin the Hunchback, his oldest son, had been disinherited and sent to a monastery, where he died in 811. Charlemagne called the court nobles together and, in their presence, crowned Louis as joint king and co-emperor. The old Germanic tradition of electing a king meant that, although he had no intention of giving the noblemen a voice in the succession, they needed to be included in the ritual. The following year, Charlemagne died. "Above all," writes his chronicler, Nithard, "I believe he will be admired for the tempered severity with which he subdued the fierce and iron hearts of Franks and barbarians. Not even Roman might had been able to tame these people, but they dared to do nothing in Charles's empire except what was in harmony with the public welfare. As emperor, Charles had done what the ancient rulers had failed to do. He had instilled civilization into those who lacked it. Guardian of civilization, defender of the Bishop of Rome, these were fine descriptions of the function of the emperor of the Romans, but Louis was not on the throne long before it became clear that the definition of emperor was already changing. Louis, who earned the nickname the Pious for his love of morality and good order, had expected to end up with one share of the Frankish land, not the whole vast thing. Now, as the second emperor of the Romans, he had unexpectedly inherited not a ceremonial title, but a huge and undivided kingdom. He at once adjusted his thinking. Charlemagne had, until the end of his life, referred to himself with the unwieldy formula Charles, Serene Augustus, governing the Roman Empire, at the same time king of the Franks and of the Lombards, which neatly separated out all the parts of his power. But the year after his accession, Louis began to call himself simply Emperor Augustus. In his mind, the different realms under his control were already merging together. Like his father, Louis crowned his sons. His oldest son, Lothair, was crowned king of Italy and co-emperor. His second son, Louis, was coronated in Bavaria, a little Germanic territory to the east that had coalesced out of the remnants of several tribes. The youngest, Pippin, became king of Aquitaine. But they ruled less as kings than as governors, under their father's hand. Louis had bound all the disparate Frankish lands under him, using the title emperor in order to tighten his grasp over the imperial realm. His sons, who, like their father, had grown up watching their grandfather treat the domains as separate, did not take well to this heavy oversight. Louis the Pious may have thought of his sons as his subjects, and his empire as a single realm, but the kings themselves viewed their kingdoms as peculiarly their own. In 829, The two different points of view clashed and threw the empire into civil war. The immediate cause of the war was Louis's clear preference for his newest son. After the death of his first wife, Louis had remarried, and his bride had given birth to another son, Charles, born in 823. Louis had a soft spot for Charles. In 829 he decided that the six-year-old should have a kingdom of his own. He chose Alemannia, the old territory of the Germanic Alemanni, now under Frankish rule. Unfortunately, Alemannia was part of Lothair's territory, so when Louis the Pious gave it to little Charles, he reduced Lothair's land. This seemed reasonable to him. He was, after all, the emperor. It was his realm to do with as he pleased. But Lothair was furious over the hostile takeover of part of his kingdom. He suggested to his two younger brothers that their kingdoms would be the next ones impoverished for the sake of the little half-brother. By 830, he had convinced Pippin of Aquitaine and Louis of Bavaria, more commonly known as Louis the German, owing to the Germanic flavor of his little patch of land, to declare war on their father. Vicious infighting between the three kings and their father raged on for 3 years. Finally, in 833, the brothers gained the upper hand. They trapped Louis the Pious and put both him and young Charles under guard. Lothair claimed the throne as emperor. He held his father and Charles in free custody, Nithard tells us, and ordered monks to keep Charles company. They were to get him used to the monastic life and urge him to take it up himself. Charles did not take the hint, however. At the same time, the deposed Louis sent a proposal to his two remaining sons, Pippin and Louis the German. He promised that he would make both of their realms larger if they would join together against Lothair and help him get his throne back. Both sons agreed. The promise of more land, Nithard remarks, made them only too eager to comply. Louis appeared unexpectedly at a public assembly, and Lothair found himself standing alone against his father and all of his brothers. He was forced to return to Italy and to swear an oath to be content with his own kingdom for the rest of his life. Relations between father and sons remained cool. In 838, Pippin died unexpectedly in Aquitaine. Louis the Pious announced that Aquitaine would now go to the half-brother Charles, whose rule over Alemannia had lasted less than a year. But the people of Aquitaine rebelled and instead crowned a king of their own, Pippin's own son, Pippin II. Louis the Pious had lost his control over Aquitaine, and a chunk of his empire had disappeared. By now, the Franks had nicknamed young Charles, Charles the Landless, sometimes translated Charles the Bald. Louis the Pious decided to give his youngest son part of his own central domain, the land of Neustria. When he died in 840, Charles became king of the Franks. Lothair was still co-emperor and king of Italy. Louis the German still sat on the Bavarian throne. Aquitaine belonged to their nephew, Pippin II. Charles the Landless held his father's throne, but neither of his two older half-brothers was in the mood to see the upstart keep power over their homeland. War began again and went on for another 3 years, largely driven by Lothair's resentment over the loss of his land. Puffed up by the imperial title, the annals of St. Bertin tell us, he took up arms against both of his brothers, Louis and Charles, and attacked first one, then the other, engaging them in battle, but with very little success in either case. In 841, an engagement between the brothers and their armies at Fontenoy left 40,000 Franks dead and shocked the Frankish world. I, Engelbert, fighting alongside the others, saw this crime unfold, wrote an eyewitness who described the carnage in verse. On the sides of both Charles and Louis, the fields are white with the shrouds of the dead, just as the fields become white with birds in autumn. This battle is not worthy of praise, not fit to be sung. Let not that accursed day be counted in the calendar of the year. While the civil war killed off Frankish warriors and destroyed crops, pirates from Scandinavia and Al-Andalus sailed down the Seine and burned Rouen, destroyed trading posts, raided the coast, and generally produced terror across the countryside. Finally, the brothers decided that they'd better make peace before the entire country went up in flames. The chronicler Regino of Prum writes that the Frankish kings, conquerors of the world, had lost so many men that they were having difficulty protecting their own frontiers. They met together in 843 and agreed to divide the empire, including Aquitaine, which had now fallen back into dependence on the larger kingdom, into three parts, more or less along the lines that Charlemagne had indicated in his will almost 40 years earlier. The division was laid out in a document known as the Treaty of Verdun, which all three of them signed. Charles the Landless got Neustria and the rest of the old Western Frankish kingdom. Louis the German took Bavaria and the Eastern Frankish lands, roughly the old territory of Austrasia, and Lothair added the lands between the Rhine and Rhone rivers to his holdings in Italy. Burgundy, where the third mayor of the palace had once ruled, was divided into two. Lothair claimed the larger part of it, the southeastern portion, and Charles the Landless got the dog's portion to the north. Author's note, Charles the Bald got Neustria, Brittany, Aquitaine, Gascony, the Spanish Marches, Septimania, and the northwestern third of Burgundy. Louis the German got East Saxony, Alemannia, Austria, Bavaria, and Carinthia. Lothair, already ruling in Italy, along with his son Louis II the Younger, got Lorraine, Alsace, Provence, the southeastern two-thirds of Burgundy, and also the northern low countries around the area of Frisia. The treaty had permanently divided the lands of the Franks back into separate realms. Once again, the empire was more of an idea than a reality. Lothair, theoretically emperor of the Romans, held no more land than the other two. Separated from the Western Frankish kingdom, Louis the German's eastern lands began to take on a slightly different character than Charles the Landless's territory in the west. The two halves of the Frankish land, Eastern Francia and Western Francia, would never be reunited. And Charles the Landless shortly found himself facing a threat that was harder to deal with than his land-hungry brothers, invaders from the north, who found the broad Loire River an ideal path into his kingdom. The invaders were Vikings, young adventurers from the Scandinavian lands, sailing out from the cold towns that could barely support their fathers' families. They had been venturing out onto the seas for centuries, but a strange shift in the weather had suddenly set them free to sail to lands where they had never been before. The shift was a phenomenon known as the medieval warm period, or the medieval climatic anomaly. Beginning around 800, temperatures in Europe had begun to rise just a few degrees, but enough to melt ice away from northern sea routes that previously had been impassable. Sailing on the cold North Sea had always been a risky proposition, possible only during certain months, but by the middle of the 9th century, the restless young men looking for wealth and adventure could sail out in search of both year-round. Vikings had been responsible for burning Rouen and wrecking the towns along the Seine during the Civil War, and they had already invaded the kingdoms to Charles's southwest. A few years earlier, a band of Vikings had targeted Pamplona, a small independent state that had grown up around the fortress Charlemagne had incautiously sacked 60 years before. Pamplona was a Christian kingdom, but it was independent from both the Emir of Cordoba and the Franks. The Vikings had kidnapped the son of Pamplona's king, Inigo I, and had demanded a sizable ransom for his release. In 844, the year after the Treaty of Verdun, Vikings also descended on the Emir of Cordoba, Abdurrahman II. He managed to drive them away. The Vikings were still more inclined to raid than to settle in for a long war, but realized that he might not be able to hold off further raids, so he began to build himself a fleet of ships. The year after, Viking pirates launched a serious invasion of Charles the Landless's kingdom. The Franks proved less able to cope with the invaders than either Inigo I or the Emir. Within a matter of weeks, Viking ships had pushed almost all the way into Paris, while their crews sacked the surrounding lands. The ships arrived outside the city on Easter Day. Charles the Landless managed to buy off their leader, the pirate Ragnar Lodbrok, with £7,000 of gold. But even after the ships retreated back down the river, the raids continued. Between 858 and 860, Viking fleets made continual raids on the southern and eastern coasts of Hispania. Other Viking ships sailed into the Mediterranean and harassed the Italian coast. Some even made it all the way across the Mediterranean and tried to raid Alexandria. In 859, Viking invaders tried again to take over Pamplona. By this time, Inigo I was dead. An ill-planned rebellion against the Emir of Cordoba had left him badly wounded and paralyzed for some time before his death, and his son, Garcia I, the former Viking hostage, was ruling Pamplona. Together with Ordono I of Asturias, the northwest Christian kingdom once recognized by Charlemagne, Garcia of Pamplona turned back the bulk of the Viking invaders. Charles the Landless was less successful. Vikings kidnapped his chaplain and forced him to pay a ransom to get the man back. They burned the great church at Poitiers and roamed through his northern land. Every time he paid them off, they would leave, but they always came back, and this made Charles less and less popular with the people who paid taxes into the Frankish treasury. "I do not think," fumed the cleric Pascasius Radbertus, "that even a few years ago any ruler on earth would have imagined that a foreigner would enter Paris. Who would have thought that such a glorious kingdom, so strong, so vast, so populous, and so vigorous, would be humiliated and smeared with the filth of such people?" In 860, Charles began to build fortified bridges at the rivers to block Viking invaders. The first bridges on the Seine proved so useful in slowing down the Viking longboats that flimsy barriers were soon going up all around the country, and Charles had to issue an edict forbidding such unauthorized strongholds to be built. His own fortifications turned out to be a very long-term project. It would be years before the bridges were completed. Meanwhile, the farms on the lowland near the mouths of the rivers remained completely vulnerable to the unexpected Viking attacks that broke out of the morning mist without warning. Farther east, the Viking influx caused a ripple that washed up and broke against the walls of Constantinople. Even before the ice had begun to melt, Scandinavian merchants had struck out from their homes, sailed across the Baltic Sea, and built settlements along the opposite coast. The settlements had remained small, the lands around them largely unconquered, but for 300 years traders had used them as stopping places on their journeys farther east. During the Caliphate of Al-Rashid, this trade had grown even busier. More and more silver dirhams had moved westward, as luxurious northern furs moved east. Bands of Scandinavian merchants made their way towards the port of Derbent on the Caspian Sea, where they traded with Khazar and Muslim merchants. The lands through which they travelled were populated by tribes who spoke a set of related languages, known to linguists as Finno-Ugrian. The Finno-Ugrian villagers didn't trade far away, nor did they use the rivers as roads as the Scandinavians did. They called the travellers who came through their villages Rus or Rus. The word may mean red, referring to the foreigner's ruddy colouring. Apparently, some of the travellers adopted this word for themselves. A Frankish chronicle tells us that back in 839, the Byzantine emperor had sent a friendly embassy to Louis the Pious to reaffirm the treaty sworn out in the days of Michael Rangab and Charlemagne. The Byzantine ambassadors were accompanied by strangers, men who said that their people were called Rus, and had been sent to him by their king, whose name was the Khagan, for the sake of friendship. To Louis the Pious, they looked like Swedes. He knew who Swedes were, and he suspected that the men were spies. But they were neither spies nor Swedes. They were traders who had settled down and intermarried with the Finno-Ugrian natives, and who now lived in a newly coalesced state ruled by a Khagan, a borrowed word for king. Their little nation was probably centered around the village of Gorodisha, or Lake Ilmen, at the southern end of the Volkhov River. Whoever the Khagan of the Rus was, he exercised only loose and informal control over the mix of Scandinavian newcomers and Finno-Ugrian natives who lived around him. But sometime around 860, as the Vikings spilled out of their native lands into the surrounding waters, a sizable party of them appear to have made their way across the northern waterways, down into the land of the Rus, where they found their distant cousins settled and prospering in trade. This was a setup for disaster. But the Khagan of the Rus knew more about Scandinavian ways than Charles the Landless. Rather than trying to drive the Vikings out and starting a minor war, he suggested that they head downriver towards Constantinople, where they would find richer targets to raid. In all likelihood, he sent a few of his own men to accompany them. Constantinople was by now under the rule of Michael III, grandson of the ambitious and capable general Michael II, who had seized the throne for himself in 820 by assassinating Leo V during Christmas Mass. Michael III had inherited the Byzantine crown in 842, at the age of two, but his mother and uncles held the real power in Constantinople. Author's note, Michael II ruled from 820 to 829, and was succeeded by his son, Theophilus, 829 to 842. Together, Michael II, Theophilus, and Michael III, 842 to 867, make up the Phrygian dynasty of Byzantine emperors. Like Charles the Landless, the regents were helpless in the face of the onslaught. 200 ships sailed down into the Black Sea, filled with thousands of raiders who came ashore, burned and plundered everything outside the walls of Constantinople, and shook their swords at the terrified people lining the walls. "They came," said the patriarch Photius afterwards, "like a thunderbolt from heaven, unlike any other attack in history in its sudden, harsh savagery." A nation dwelling somewhere far from our country, barbarous, nomadic, armed with arrogance, unwatched, unchallenged, leaderless, has so suddenly, in the twinkling of an eye, like a wave of the sea, poured over our frontiers, and as a wild boar has devoured the inhabitants of the land like grass or straw or a crop. Oh, the God-sent punishment that befell us, sparing nothing from man to beast, not respecting female weakness, not pitying tender infants, not reverencing the hoary hairs of old men, softened by nothing that is wont to move human nature to pity, but boldly thrusting their sword through persons of every age and sex. The raids went on for a little over a week before the raiders sailed away from Constantinople's locked gates. Michael's regents immediately claimed that fear of the Byzantine reprisals had driven the enemy away, but raiding and retreating was what the Vikings did best. It was their natural pattern to arrive, plunder, and leave. Ruins along the Volkhov River hint that the Viking visitors may have fallen out with their Rus hosts before returning home. Just a year or two after the attack on Constantinople, fires destroyed part of Gorodisha and all of the nearby village of Staraya Ladoga. The Russian Primary Chronicle, written 250 years later, says that in 862, the Viking warrior Rurik settled in Europe and built himself a kingdom among the native Slavs, with his capital at Novgorod. The chronicle adds that he had to fight other Vikings for control of the subject Slavs. Rurik is probably legendary, but his tale gives us a glimpse of what may have been a real struggle between the Viking newcomers and the Rus, who had already settled down along the Volkhov. It seems that the resident Rus eventually came out on top, but their numbers seem to have swelled suddenly, suggesting that at least a few of the Viking newcomers also settled down and stayed. The wooden buildings of Gorodisha were repaired. Staraya Ladoga was rebuilt, this time in stone. The Rus, resisting and adapting at the same time, had absorbed the Viking wave. It was a flexibility that neither the Emperor of Constantinople nor the kings of the Frankish Empire possessed. Chapter 57. Long-Lived Kings. Between 814 and 900, three Indian kingdoms battle for Kanauj in the north, while a new king in the south gains power by fighting and wealth by trading with the eastern islands. In the north of India, three kingdoms touched edges at the city of Kanauj. Three strong and long-lived kings, each the son of a strong and long-lived king, ruled over the intersecting realms. The Pala were ruled by Devapala, who had inherited from his father Dharmapala a realm swelled by captured territory, the Pratihara by Nagabata II, whose father, Vatsaraja, had, in a 30-year reign, managed to strengthen and establish the Pratihara as a power to be reckoned with. And in 814, the 13-year-old King Amoghavarsha received from his father, Govinda III, the enormous Rashtrakuta Empire. Author's note, the Pratihara are also known as the Gujara Pratihara. The word Gurjara probably refers to their ancestry, as descendants of the Central Asian Gurjaras who came down through the northern mountains just after the fall of the Guptas. Kanauj, filled with Hindu temples and Buddhist monasteries, had been the capital city of the great King Harsha 2 centuries earlier. It had grown into a metropolis, and all three kings coveted it. Already the city had passed back and forth between the Pala and Pratihara kings, much to the dismay of the citizens, who had to flee for cover whenever a new army stormed through the gates. It was extremely uncomfortable to live in a symbol of dominance. In 814, the city was in the hands of the Pala king Devapala, but the Pratihara king Nagabata II planned to take it away. Nagabata II was in his 9th year of reign. He had already campaigned successfully against the Pala king, annexing some of the northern Pala lands, the old territory of Magadha, for his own. He had also driven off a Muslim attempt to storm across the Sindh into his land and capture his capital city of Ujjain. He crushed the large armies of the powerful Mleka king, the destroyer of virtue, his inscription at the city of Gwalior tells us, using the traditional Indian name for these Arabic-speaking invaders. By 820, perhaps earlier, Nagabata II had driven the Pala forces out of the city of Kanauj and was holding court there himself. Nagabata alone gladdens the heart of the three worlds, his inscriptions boast. He revealed himself even as the rising sun, the sole source of manifestation of the three worlds, reveals himself by vanquishing dense and terrible darkness. The kings of Andhra, Sindhu, Vidarbha, and Kalinga succumbed to his youthful energy as moths do to fire. The inscriptions are undoubtedly political spin, but if there is any truth in them at all, then the Pratihara Empire of Nagabata II had not only pushed into Pala territory, but also taken land away from the Rashtrakuta Empire. The Rashtrakuta domain had shrunk since Govinda's death. The teenaged Amoghavarsha, barely old enough to inherit, had been forced to spend the first decade of his reign putting down rebellions against his power. In fact, revolt had grown so pervasive that in 818, Amoghavarsha fled from his own country and left his elderly cousin Karka to deal with the problems on his own. Karka not only did so, but, once the king had returned and the Rashtrakuta Empire was back under control, retired to his family lands on the western coast instead of seizing the throne for himself. Unfortunately for Amoghavarsha, Karka's son Dhruva was not as loyal. As soon as the old man died, Dhruva declared his own independence, and Amoghavarsha spent the next 20 years fighting him into submission. Thanks to all these domestic troubles, Amoghavarsha had been in no position to resist the Pratihara attacks. Given the essential likeness of the Indian kingdoms across the subcontinent, they had more or less the same governments, armies, and military playbooks, their fates were decided by two interlocking qualities: the spark of ambition in each king, and that king's ability to stay on the throne long enough to fan the spark into fire. Amoghavarsha, king of the shrinking Rashtrakuta realm, was not essentially a warlike ruler. He built a beautiful new cave temple in the city of Ellora, wrote poetry, dabbled in art, and left defense of the realm to his generals. But he sat on the throne long enough to give his kingdom a stability that resisted complete conquest. The Pratihara were temporarily dominant, but the Pala were still strong, and the Rashtrakuta did not dwindle completely away. The triumphant Nagabata II died in 833, and the Pratihara fortunes wavered a bit. His short-lived son and successor spent only 3 years on the throne before dying, and his grandson, Miharbhoj, had to beat off a Pala attempt to invade. Miharbhoj's first forays against the Pala king Devapala were triumphant, but then the tide began to turn against him. Devapala was in the third decade of a 40-year reign, and his experience allowed him to resist the attacks of the younger Pratihara king with increasing success. His own inscriptions claim that he reconquered land from the Himalaya down to the Vindhya range, poetically described as piles of rock which are moist with the rutting juice of elephants. Devapala, another inscription boasts, brought low the arrogance of the lord of the Pratihara. But the coincidence of long life, which had led first the Pratihara and then the Pala into victory, abruptly abandoned the Pala. Devapala died in 850 and was succeeded by short-lived rulers incapable of following up on his conquests. Miharbhoj of the Pratihara, who would remain on the throne for another 36 years, pushed back into the lost territory. He wished to conquer the three worlds, an inscription notes. Slowly the pendulum swung back to the west. In Miharbhoj's final years, the Pratihara kingdom grew to enormous size. The Pala were reduced to a minor tributary in the east. Miharbhoj was still on the Pratihara throne when Amoghavarsha of the Rashtrakuta finally died in 878. He had reigned for an astounding 64 years, and although he had none of the aggressive campaigning skills of his neighbour, his longevity had lent the Rashtrakuta kingdom a tenacious coherence. But Amoghavarsha's son and successor, Krishna II, no more warlike than his father, lacked his father's tough resilience. Almost at once, the eastern Chalukya, who had been weak and fragmented for decades, showed new strength and declared their opposition to Krishna II. And the Pratihara launched new attacks against his borders. Krishna II, troubled in the north, was equally unsuccessful in the south. He had the misfortune to lie between two energetic, ambitious kings, Miharbhoj in the north, and a newly crowned southern ruler named Aditya. The far south of India had been in the hands of two competing powers, the Pallava and the Pandya, for centuries. Aditya belonged to a clan that had been subject to the Pallava, the Chola clan. His father, the Chola warlord, Vijayala, had been permitted by the Pallava king to attack the city of Thanjavur and take it as his headquarters. In Thanjavur, the Chola chief then took advantage of the ongoing preoccupation of the Pallava and Pandya kings with each other and conquered a kingdom. Aditya, coming to his father's throne in 871, would rule for nearly 40 years, another long-lived king with ambitions. His tenure allowed his Chola domain to grow stronger and richer. Chola merchants carried on active sea trade to the east, sending ships across the Indian Ocean to the island of Sumatra. After the disastrous eruption of Krakatoa in 535, the people of Sumatra had slowly returned to rebuild their villages and replough their fields. The Sumatran village of Jambi had grown into a city and spread its authority across the water to the eastern parts of Java, and by the 9th century, Java, Sumatra, and the peninsula that jutted down from the Asian mainland were all under the rule of a single king. The Chola knew this as the Srivijayan Empire, a wealthy and powerful trading partner that could help the Chola rise to dominance in the south. By the end of the 9th century, Aditya had killed the Pallava king and claimed his land, and had begun to chip away at the southern border of the Rashtrakuta. Like the Pratihara kings far to the north, his long life had allowed him to realize his ambitions, the foundations of a new dynasty. Whatever legitimacy a king claimed for himself, whether he announced that his right to rule came from blood or bone, from the anointing of priests or the possession of a divine mandate, that legitimacy only mattered as long as the king lived. And in India, over the course of the 9th century, the lifespans of the rulers had determined the advance and retreat of power. At the beginning of the century, the struggle in India had been centered in the north, with armies fighting for dominance from east to west and back again. By the century's end, the axis of conflict had shifted. The struggle was a vertical one now, with the Pratihara on the north, the Rashtrakuta in the center, and the Chola in the far south, all positioned for conquest. The king of Rashtrakuta sat in the most precarious place, sandwiched between two tenacious neighbors who could reach each other only by going through him. Chapter 58. Foreign and Domestic Relations. Between 856 and 886, Byzantine missionaries invent a new Slavic alphabet. Louis the German and Michael III joust over Moravia and Bulgaria, and Michael III's complicated domestic arrangements catch up with him. In 856, Michael III of Byzantium turned 16 years old and assumed power with a careful ruthlessness. He declared his most trustworthy uncle his heir, ordered the other regents exiled or assassinated, and shipped his mother and sisters off to a nunnery. Constantinople was relatively stable, thanks in large part to Michael's mother and uncle. They had presided over a council that restored icon use to Byzantium and brought a final end to over a century of theological struggle. But the empire's encounters with outside powers had been disastrous. The Rus had raided its land at will, Abbasid armies had beaten its troops in battle, and the Khazars had refused offers of closer alliance. In 862, Michael was given a chance to reverse the empire's bad luck at foreign relations. A letter from a king named Rastislav arrived at his court, asking for help. "We have no one to teach us the truth and to explain to us the meaning of scripture," Rastislav wrote. "Send us then, Lord, a man capable of teaching us the whole truth." It was more than a chance to send missionaries. It was an opportunity to change the political landscape. Rastislav's kingdom, Moravia, was less than 40 years old. His uncle, Mojmir, the leader of a Slavic tribe north of Bulgaria, had conquered the tribe next door and united the two territories. Mojmir had ruled this kingdom from 833 until 846, and when he died, Louis the German, now king of eastern Francia, had sent his own soldiers into Moravia to make sure that Rastislav would inherit his uncle's throne. This was not a kindness on Louis's part. He wanted Moravia's king to be dependent on him, and the kingdom itself under Frankish supervision. Louis had dispatched his own Frankish missionaries to evangelize the Moravians, hoping to convert them into the Roman Church, which would have given him another layer of control over Moravia's people. Rastislav could see that Louis the German intended to swallow his kingdom whole. He cast his eye eastward and decided that his people would be better off submitting themselves to the Patriarch of Constantinople, who owed no political favors to the Franks. Michael III saw the request for what it was, a chance to whip Moravia out of Frankish hands. He immediately sent two missionaries to the Moravian court. They were brothers named Cyril and Methodius, who had already traveled together as missionaries to the Khazars. It was an unsuccessful mission, as the Khazars declined to convert from Judaism. They were natives of Thessalonica, which had a large Slavic population, and they had spoken Slavic languages from birth. Author's note: Cyril is also widely known as Constantine, the name he used before becoming a monk. Cyril and Methodius arrived at Rastislav's court in 863, bearing gifts from Michael III and copies of the sacred liturgy used in the churches of Constantinople. But before the Moravians could be folded into the traditions of the Eastern Church, the liturgies would have to be translated into Slavonic, and Slavonic had no written form. Cyril, undaunted, invented a new alphabet called Glagolitic, from the Slavic word for speak, basing it on the Greek letters known as uncials. He and his brother spent the next 3 years translating the liturgy and the Gospels into Moravian. The first passage written down in this newborn language was from the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word. Moravian was still considered a barbaric language. Certainly it ranked far, far below Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, the three languages written by tradition above the cross of Christ, as an acceptable tongue for worship. This made no difference to Michael III or to his missionaries. Giving the Slavs their own language, a language tied to the Greek of the East rather than the Latin of the West, did that much more to weaken Frankish control. While the brothers were still in Moravia, Michael III discovered that Louis the German was hedging his bets. He was also sending Frankish missionaries into Bulgaria in an attempt to do exactly what Michael III was doing in Moravia. Bulgaria was too big, too close, and too well-armed to risk a Frankish-Bulgarian alliance, and Michael III decided not to play around with competing monks this time. He assembled his army and prepared to invade. Bulgaria was too important to leave to the missionaries. The king of Bulgaria, Boris, had been considering conversion for some time. He had gone so far as to send a message to Louis the German, announcing that he was ready to join the Roman Church. But the Bulgarian aristocracy was appalled by the possibility. His leading men were very angry, the Annals of St. Bertin tells us, and stirred up his people against him, aiming to kill him. All the warriors there were in all the 10 counties of that realm came and surrounded the king's palace. Boris backtracked and stalled on a final decision, sending messages to Louis the German that he had more questions and needed more priests to come and answer them. But when Michael III's army appeared on his frontiers, and the Byzantine navy drew up to the shores of the Black Sea, Boris changed tactics. He made a deal with Michael. He would convert and be baptized in Constantinople, taking the baptismal name Michael in honor of the emperor, and in return, the Byzantine forces would withdraw. Michael III, impressed with his success so far, now sent a missionary upriver to the Rus, but no conversions resulted. The Rus were not interested, and the mission in Moravia and Bulgaria, like all of Michael III's foreign maneuvers, did not do him much good in the end. Boris, now Michael I of Bulgaria, remained Christian, but in 866 he announced that he would submit himself to the Pope. Then, in 870, he reversed himself again and resubmitted Bulgaria to the Patriarch of Constantinople. This, too, would be temporary. He had already decided that what Bulgaria really needed was its own state church, neither Roman nor Byzantine, in order to preserve Bulgarian independence. Over in Moravia, Cyril and Methodius were trying to complete their work. Cyril died of illness in 869, begging his brother to continue the mission. So Methodius went on, faithfully translating the scriptures into Slavic. But a little more than a year after Cyril's death, Louis the German managed to reassert himself in Moravia. He promised to help King Rastislav's nephew, Svatopluk, usurp the throne. In 870, Frankish armies accompanied Svatopluk to the royal palace, arrested Rastislav, and handed him over to Louis. Louis took revenge for Rastislav's turn to the east by blinding and jailing him. Rastislav died in prison not long after. Svatopluk now ruled Moravia, and Louis the German controlled him. Frankish bishops, coming into Moravia to reorient its Christianity back towards Rome, managed to have Methodius arrested and thrown into jail. No one paid much attention to him there, and it was almost 3 years before the Pope learned of his fate and ordered Louis the German to release him. Methodius tried to pick his work back up, but the theological tide had turned against him. The Moravian Christians who had welcomed his efforts were now fleeing into Bulgaria to avoid any trouble with the Frankish bishops. When Methodius died in 885, his work in Moravia was in tatters. But the Moravians who had chosen exile in Bulgaria passed their liturgy and scripture on to the Bulgarian clerics. The Bulgarian churches began to use Methodius's works in preference to the Greek rituals, distancing themselves bit by bit from the Eastern church hierarchy. Methodius's disciples, attempting to follow the example of their master, began to create a new script, again based on Greek uncials, meant especially for the Bulgarian tongue. They named this script Cyrillic, after the missionary Cyril, and it took root and grew. A decade later, the Bulgarian Church forbade its clerics to use any Greek in the liturgy. The Bulgarian Church would now worship only in its own native language. Methodius and Cyril had set out to free Moravia from the Franks. Instead, they freed Bulgaria from both Rome and Constantinople, but neither lived to see this. Meanwhile, Michael III was suffering from domestic troubles. The troubles were almost entirely self-inflicted. Since the age of 15, he had been sleeping with the same woman, his favourite mistress, Eudokia Ingerina. However, his mother announced that Ingerina was not an acceptable wife, and instead ordered him to marry a woman she had handpicked for him, Eudokia Decapolitissa. Michael had trouble defying his mother. He agreed to marry Decapolitissa, and then after the wedding ignored her and went right on sleeping with Ingerina. The patriarch disapproved of this crowded marriage, and to preserve appearances, Michael married off his mistress Ingerina to his best friend, a horse trainer from Macedonia named Basil. Michael continued sleeping with her, however, and so that Basil would not be deprived, he brought one of his sisters out of her convent and installed her at court as Basil's mistress. What with climbing in and out of each other's beds, Michael III and Basil became closer, and Basil began to get a glimpse of what real power could be like. He began to suggest to Michael III that Michael's uncle and heir had too much influence around the court, and finally convinced Michael to give him permission to murder the unfortunate man. In his uncle's place, Michael made Basil his co-emperor and heir. In 867, he also legally adopted Basil as his son. He was 27. Basil was 56. This weird adoption made a twisted kind of sense. The year before, Ingerina had given birth to a son. Technically, the child was Basil's. In all likelihood, he was actually Michael's. So, by adopting Basil, Michael became his illegitimate son's legitimate grandfather, and the little boy, Leo, had a legitimate path to claim the throne. Unfortunately, the path led through Basil. Now that he was adopted, co-emperor and heir, Basil had no more use for Michael. After a drunken banquet one night, later in 867, Michael III staggered off to bed. Basil's men murdered the emperor in his sleep, and Basil claimed the throne for himself as Basil I, founder of the new Macedonian dynasty. Basil maintained peace, more or less, with most of his neighbours, except for the Abbasid Empire. The two empires continued their pattern of inconclusive and damaging battles, with the high or low point, the Arab capture in 878 of the city of Syracuse on Sicily, which until this point had been Byzantine. Basil's greatest project as emperor was an attempt to revise and update the laws of Justinian. He intended to publish the updated laws in an enormous collection that would be called Purification of the Old Law. It was an odd project for a man who had come to the throne in such a sideways manner, and it was never finished. At some point, Basil also began sleeping with his wife, since she bore him two more sons after Michael's death. Basil, understandably, displayed a marked preference for his younger sons over his oldest. In 866, Basil was hunting with his attendants when he rode out ahead of them to pursue a huge stag. The animal turned on him. Basil's horse bolted and threw him onto the stag's antlers, and the stag dragged him through the woods until one of his guards caught up with him and cut him loose. Basil, badly wounded, had just enough strength left to accuse the guard of trying to kill him with the drawn sword the man had used to free him. He ordered the guard put to death, and died not long afterwards. Only the introduction to his great purification was ever published. When Basil's entourage returned to Constantinople with this story of his death, it was greeted with scepticism. More than one chronicler suggested that it was covering up some sort of assassination plot, perhaps directed by Basil's son Leo. Relations between the two had grown sourer as Leo grew, which merely fed the rumours that Leo was actually the son of the dead Michael. But Leo was never publicly accused of Basil's death. He was crowned emperor. Shortly afterwards, he had Michael's body exhumed from its burial place in a monastery outside of Constantinople and reburied in Constantine the Great's own mausoleum. Chapter 59. The Second Caliphate. Between 861 and 909, Turkish soldiers take control of the Abbasid Caliphate, new dynasties break away in the east, and the new caliph proclaims himself in Egypt. In early December of 861, the Abbasid caliph was murdered. The murder of a caliph was not anything new or startling, but by 861, the surface tension that held the Islamic world together was already strained by cross-currents of doctrine and practice, and this particular assassination strengthened those currents until the surface unity finally and fatally burst apart. The chain of events that led to this particular murder had begun back in the early years of the century, with the Caliph al-Ma'mun himself. Before his death in 834, al-Ma'mun had developed a particular interest in a form of doctrine known as Mu'tazilism, which suggested that he had the responsibility to purify the community by force, if necessary. The Mu'tazilites believed that God was perfect reason, which meant that his divine judgment of men, both sinners and righteous, was also completely rational. In Mu'tazilism, there was no uncertainty about God's intentions. There was no need to appeal for mercy. Mercy required the giver to change his mind about the severity of an offence, and God did not share in such human qualities as changing one's mind. God was so completely transcendent, so far beyond the limitations of man's existence, that he was almost an abstraction. Divine logic. Like all medieval and modern arguments about the nature of God, this one had a political edge to it. Mu'tazilite leaders argued that since men have the ability to reason, they can think their way to a clear understanding of right and wrong. They can predict with certainty what God's judgment on their acts will be. They may not always choose the righteous act, however, and so it is the leader's job to guide the community in right belief and right practice. Author's note, Mu'tazilism had five foundational principles. Sayyid Hossein Nasr defines them as unity, God's nature as a single transcendent being, justice, God's judgment governed by rational principle, the promise and the threat, those who obey will be given rewards, while those who fail to repent will suffer eternal torment. The in-between position, in relation to Muslims who commit sins, they are in the moment of sinning neither believers nor infidels, but something in between, and the leader's responsibility to exhort the community to do good and forbid them to do evil. It is also the leader's job to stamp out wrong belief and evil practice, and al-Ma'mun had taken this task quite seriously. He instituted an inquisition, the mihna, or ordeal. Teachers, scholars, and leaders were subjected to intense questioning, which sometimes involved quite forceful persuasion, until the interrogated were convinced that Mu'tazilite ideas were true. In many cases, the conviction was shallow. Agreeing hastily to the doctrines that al-Ma'mun decreed improved the chances of quick release from his prisons. But al-Ma'mun, who died just as his inquisition was getting underway, did not quite grasp this truth. He left orders to his half-brother and heir, al-Mutasim, to continue the inquisition, convinced that it would not only make the Islamic community stronger, but also bolster the power of the caliphate. Unfortunately, al-Mutasim, carrying out his brother's wishes, ran slap into another difficulty. Mu'tazilite doctrine assured him that as caliph, he had the authority to reward good and punish evil, and to define what good and evil were. But he ruled in a world where Muslims were increasingly divided over who could claim the right to be the true caliph, the rightful leader of the community. The arguments about who should be caliph had been going on for two centuries. Many Muslims still believed that the Islamic world should be led by a direct descendant of the Prophet. They had hoped, since the death of Muhammad's son-in-law Ali back in 661, to see a descendant of Ali and his wife, the Prophet's daughter Fatima, become caliph. Instead, the caliphate had been taken over first by the Umayyads and then in 750 by the Abbasids, who traced their descent back to Muhammad's uncle, but not to Muhammad himself. At both crises of leadership, the supporters of Ali, the Shia, had called for a caliph of Ali's blood. Neither time had their voices been strong enough to triumph against the majority, known as the Sunni. So the party of Ali, rejecting the caliphs as illegitimate, had exalted its own series of leaders, not caliphs, but imams, religious leaders who refused to swear allegiance to the caliphate. The Shia, a relatively small group who lived within the Sunni majority, sometimes peacefully, sometimes in a state of minor war, were willing to obey their imams without question. They believed that the Prophet himself had designated his successor, and that each imam had the God-given infallible knowledge that allowed him to designate the next successor. The imams could not make mistakes, because they were filled with the wisdom of the divine. But the Abbasid caliph could not boast the same kind of authority that the Shia granted to their imams. Sunni Muslims chose their caliphs. The pool of candidates was limited to the Abbasid line, but the caliph himself was elected by the community, which was a problem for al-Mutasim, because while God and the Prophet were incapable of error, the community of Muslims might realize after electing a caliph that they had blundered. And if a caliph started arresting and torturing members of the community who disagreed with him, it was very likely that the community might decide that he was a mistake sooner rather than later. During his caliphate, al-Mutasim had to put down 3 separate major revolts and a handful of minor ones. It became very clear that if the caliph were to hold on to his power, he needed an army that came from outside the community, an army that would fight for him but had no right to remove him from power in favor of another candidate. Al-Mutasim formed this army around the core of his own personal guard, captives who had been brought back to Baghdad after wars with the Western Turkish Khaganate and other Turkish tribes across the Oxus River. These Turkish captives had become slaves to the Abbasid Caliphate, and many of the slaves were trained to be soldiers in the Abbasid army. Those who did well were often set free, and some were even given government offices to hold. The influx of Turks into Baghdad had been constant over the last century of warring, and al-Mutasim had a personal guard of 4,000 Turkish slave soldiers even before he became caliph. As caliph, he began to transform this guard into a real army. Within just a few years, he had expanded his force until he had 70,000 men under his control, mostly Turks, but also a few Slavs and North Africans who had been captured in battle and brought to the capital as slaves. These men, chosen for the specific reason that they were outsiders, now surrounded and protected the caliph, pushing his Arab and Persian officials to the edge of the inner circle. Resentment grew in Baghdad. Continual scuffles, and worse, broke out on the streets between Turks and the men they had supplanted. Finally, al-Mutasim decided to move his capital to another city, north along the Tigris to Samarra, where he constructed separate quarters for his Turks and kept them isolated from the population. This prevented street riots, but it also transformed the Turks into a highly cohesive, self-contained community that had no particular loyalty to Muslim doctrine. Al-Mutasim was succeeded first by his older son and then by his younger son, al-Mutawakkil, both of them living in Samarra. During the caliphates of both, the Turkish community strengthened until the Turks were the single most powerful segment of Abbasid society. In 861, all of these tensions came to a head when the caliph al-Mutawakkil threatened to disinherit his oldest son, al-Muntasir. The young man went to the Turks and persuaded them that they would prosper better under his rule than under the rule of any of his brothers. Before al-Mutawakkil could carry through on his threat, his Turkish guards murdered him in his own quarters and arrayed themselves behind al-Muntasir's election as the new caliph. Al-Muntasir died of illness shortly after his ascension, and the Turkish army picked the next caliph as well. When he displeased them, they tried to depose him. He fled to Baghdad and barricaded himself inside the city. The Turks laid siege to the old capital and, after a year, forced the powerless caliph to abdicate and chose a new one. Baghdad, now under Turkish control, became once again the political center of the caliphate. Brought from the outside to protect the power of the caliph, the Turks had become kingmakers. The newly chosen caliph, al-Mutaz, lasted only 3 years. In a massive miscalculation, he spent too much money on his court and ran out of cash to pay his army. Once again, the Turks intervened. Al-Tabari preserves an eyewitness account of what happened when they dragged the 24-year-old caliph from his palace. "I thought that they had already beaten him with clubs, for he came out with his shirt torn in several places and traces of blood on his shoulders. They stood him in the sun in the palace at that time when the heat is oppressive. I saw him lift his foot time and again due to the heat of the place where he had been made to stand. I also saw some of them slap him as he tried to protect himself with his hand. After he had been deposed, he was reportedly given over to someone who tortured him, and he was forbidden food and water for 3 days. Finally, they plastered a small vault with heavy plaster, put him in it, and shut the door behind him. By the next morning, the young caliph was dead. The Turks were in power, and one thing had become perfectly clear. The Abbasid caliph might claim to be God's spokesman, but that claim would no longer protect him. The loss of control over the palace at Baghdad was mirrored by the caliphate's loss of control over the eastern reaches that had once belonged to the Abbasid Empire. The Tayyarids of Khorasan, descendants of the general Tahir, were still ruling over the territory that had been given them by al-Mamun half a century earlier, but their power was soon shaken. In 867, a coppersmith-turned-bandit named Yaqub Ilayt Safari began conquering himself a territory south of his home city of Zaranj, halfway between the Tigris and the Indus. The Tirids tried to defend their realm, but by 873, Safari had fought all the way to the Tahirid capital city, Nishapur. He captured the young Tahirid ruler and took the city for himself. The Tahirid dynasty was shattered. It had lasted only 70 years. Safari then began to advance towards Baghdad, intending to storm the city and force the caliph to grant him official recognition as a legitimate Muslim ruler. The caliph, of course, was more or less powerless. The Turks had put another hand-picked candidate, Al-Mutamid, into the caliphate, and he would survive for 22 years by allowing his officials and army to control the palace. But although the illusion of a God-ordained caliph was flickering, it was still functioning. Even as he built his own separate empire, Safari wanted the caliph's stamp of approval. The chaos of the last 20 years made the most straightforward solution, sending an army large enough to wipe out Safari's rebellion, impractical. Instead, the caliph's officials set out to find an ally who could help by pressuring Safari on the other side. A message was sent to the city of Samarkand, on the far side of the Oxus River, offering the governor there the title Ruler of Transoxania, if he would rally his forces against Safari. The governor was named Nasra, and he too was worried about Safari's expanding power. His family, the Persian clan of the Samanids, had been governors of Samarkand since 819, and for some years they had been the strongest power east of the Tahirids. Now that the Tahirids were gone, Safari would likely turn on the Samanids in the future. Nasra agreed to the caliph's proposal, and the Samanid family became rulers of Transoxania. Led by Nasra's brother Ismail, the Samanids began to fight against Safari from the northeast, while the Turkish army, in the name of the Abbasids, erected defences in the west. In 876, the Turks and Abbasids won a victory against Safari's men, halting the advance towards Baghdad. They also recaptured the young Tahirid ruler Muhammad, who had been held prisoner by Safari's army for the last 3 years. They sent him back to Khorasan so that he could try to take up the governorship again, but his power was shattered, his authority gone.